As Texas reports 10,000 new COVID cases, the state education agency announces guidelines for going back to school in the fall. Details today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. With unemployment high, the special struggle to keep up with demand for food in remote parts of West Texas. Texas Senator John Cornyn claims the last top-to-bottom criminal justice review was more than a half a century ago. Is he right? A PolitiFact check. Also, a new documentary on a flamboyant fortune teller who became a cultural icon for many in Texas and way beyond. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started. That happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 8th day of July, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. Hard to believe it wasn't quite 3 weeks ago. Governor Greg Abbott said Texas public schools would be reopening in the fall, and the Texas Education Agency, the TEA, was set to unveil an outline for students, teachers, and staff to return to school campuses for in-person instruction, reported to be light on safety guidelines. But when those details failed to materialize, well, it was clear that either the plans weren't quite ready or that a serious rethink was happening behind the scenes. Within hours, the governor's narrative of Texas's grand reopening turned upside down as coronavirus case numbers started to soar and as hospital beds began to fill statewide. Fast forward to yesterday, as the state released data showing 10,000 new COVID cases, a record number, the TEA issued its long-awaited back-to-school guidelines. The document calls for masks for students and teachers in counties with more than 20 COVID cases, parental choice for online or in-person classes, health screening for campus access, and more. Now, there are plenty of asterisks here, qualifications and caveats too, and not all rules will apply to all students in all parts of Texas. Jacob Carpenter is covering this story. He's an education reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Jacob, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
A bit to break down here, but what are the main takeaways that the TEA is suggesting when it comes to public schools and what cautionary moves they should implement this fall?
Sure. Well, I think the biggest takeaway from yesterday's guidance was really that schools have to offer 5 days of in-person instruction to any student that wants it. There were many schools that were looking at trying to do some kind of hybrid model where students would only come to school maybe 2 or 3 days a week, and then they would continue to learn from home the other 2 or 3 days. But that isn't really an option that that can be forced on families anymore. When it comes to safety guidance, masks are going to be required as long as Governor Abbott's mask mandate stays in place. If that is rescinded or goes away at some point, it'll be the discretion of local school districts to decide what they want to do when it comes to requiring masks for students and staff. And the state has really given a lot of discretion to local school districts to make their own decisions about what type of safety measures to put in place. There are very few mandates, but there are a lot of recommendations around things like social distancing, things like hand washing and having hand sanitizer available.
I want to talk on that hybrid model just a bit more, because you write that some schools in the Houston area, before this plan was released, had been proposing this hybrid model where you might have certain groups of students coming to school different times during the week. Am I correct in saying these TEA guidelines would not allow that, right? Either a parent has to commit their student to being in the classroom full-time or remote full-time?
So there's a little bit of ambiguity on that of whether a family can decide, you know, we want to come to school for just a couple days during the week. But the big and clear upshot is that a school district cannot tell a student you can only come 2 days a week if you wanted to come 5 days a week.
I see what you're saying. When it comes to masks, there are, I mentioned, a few asterisks here. For instance, children 10 and younger won't have to wear masks, as I understand it. And, of course, this parental choice only applies to those districts where there is an online option for classes. Not all districts have such a thing, right?
No, districts must offer an online option if they want to receive funding for those students who would be learning online. And this the funding is going to be key for every district. So I will be stunned if any district does not offer online learning. You know, what the TEA or what the state has really emphasized is that for those families that are concerned about health of their students and concerned about their children bringing home the virus, there will be an option available to them to continue their online learning. And school districts are heavily, heavily incentivized to make sure that they are offering that option to their students, to all their students at all their schools.
Uh-huh. Now, I know that there's been a lot of anxiety expressed by parents, by school teachers and staff, too. What are the reactions you've been hearing?
Sure. It runs the gamut from there are families who, you know, have to work or have working parents, families who have seen the really harmful effects of not having their kids in school, who want their students back in the classroom. There are others who are really fearful about the unknowns of coronavirus. You know, we know that that children are susceptible, or children display the symptoms of COVID-19 at very, very low rates compared to adults. But there's less certainty about how often they're infected and maybe asymptomatic. There's less certainty about how they may spread it to adults. And so you have a lot of parents who are fearful of that. And you also have a lot of staff members who are fearful of that. And there's going to be a looming battle in districts where you have staff members who you have a greater percentage of staff who want to stay home out of concern of being infected than the percentage of families that want to resume in-person classes.
Well, are critics offering alternatives to the TEA plan, something they think is more workable?
Yeah, I think they want to see, first off, I think a lot of them want to see more mandates from the state when it comes to things like social distancing, when it comes to things like masks, and to possibly employing something like a hybrid model, where really the point of that is to limit the number of people that are in a building at one time so that you're more able to social distance, you're more able to enforce the protocols that you do have.
Jacob Carpenter is an education reporter for the Houston Chronicle. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Jacob, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
You thought grocery shopping during a pandemic was hard. Try holding an election. As you likely know by now, early voting is well underway in Texas's rescheduled runoffs, and as local elections officials put in place pandemic safety precautions, KACU's Heather Claiborne in Abilene reports many see what's happening now as a test run for November.
In downtown Abilene, tape on the floor of the polling station at the Taylor County Plaza shows voters how to keep 6 feet of distance while waiting in line. There's a hand sanitizer dispenser just inside the door and jugs of it sitting on tables. Taylor County's Elections Administrator Frieda Reagan says volunteers will offer voters disposable gloves and face masks.
Every election does present its own unique challenges. However, COVID-19 has created its own unique set of challenges.
Another challenge is that for early voting during the runoffs, Taylor County has only one polling location instead of the usual five. The other places, like grocery stores, don't have the space to keep booths 6 feet apart.
Some of the other locations that we're typically at, were a little hesitant because of the virus and concerned about voting and the number of people that may come in and gather at that one location.
Reagan is scouting new locations and volunteers for November, though some of the usual poll workers may not be available, like people who are at high risk of developing COVID-19. Dale Bowker, an Air Force retiree and retired state corrections worker, says he has no concerns.
It's just going to be really silly, I think. I'm kind of a non-participant in the COVID-19 thingy. I will help Frieda with the election because I've done it for so long. And she does need the help.
Bowker says he'd do almost anything for Frieda. Almost.
It's going to be the plastic shield that I will wear if they give me that option. If I have to wear the cloth mask or paper mask, I will not do that.
Taylor County does have face shields for poll workers. Linda Goolsby usually helps with elections, but she won't be volunteering this year.
Even though I've feel sure they have done everything in their power for the distancing and all of that. And I always wear a mask when I go out. My husband and I are both in the age group that would be hit the hardest, and we would not have easy cases, and I just can't take that chance.
Goolsbee is also mailing in her ballot this year and thinks everyone should be able to vote by mail. But the Texas Supreme Court ruled that lack of immunity to COVID-19 doesn't make voters eligible for a mail ballot. Still, Frieda Reagan says requests for mail ballots in Taylor County are up 38% over the March primary. And, she adds, her office doesn't have time to verify each mail ballot applicant's claims.
Each voter needs to assess their own situation. And if they feel like they meet that criteria, then they need to just submit a request to our office. And then we will process their application and send them a ballot.
Reagan says there's another option for nervous voters, curbside voting.
We simply lift the tablet out of its docking station and take the tablet out to the voter, and then they can cast their ballot in the privacy and the comfort of their vehicle.
But she says that takes more time. She says voters will need extra patience now and in November. For the Texas Standard, I'm Heather Claiborne.
Wells Dunbar is monitoring what Texans are talking about on social media. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. Hearing from lots of folks about this new guidance from the Texas Education Agency calling for masks and other safety protocols when schools open in the fall. Here's some of what folks are saying on Facebook. Jessica Ellie says, why aren't testing protocols being discussed when it comes to schools reopening? Something like a random sampling. And Ruth De Helgard says they could also do pooled testing, which would give schools useful information about the general health of the population there with fewer privacy concerns. However, Tammy Kimmelman says if masks are needed, then it's too soon to reopen. And Amber Briggle says, honestly, I think the biggest problem with masks this fall will be the parents who don't take masks seriously this summer. Start modeling responsible adult behavior around your kids regarding this. Get some masks that actually fit your face. Practice wearing them over your mouth and nose. If y'all want to get back to normal, we'll all have to chip in and do our part. Obviously, lots more to unpack there with this new announcement from the TEA, David. I'll be back with more results and more reactions from social media later in the show.
In fact, in about 35 minutes or so, when we hear more from our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, who's covering the Talk of Texas on this Wednesday. The Texas Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town. Tours with social distancing at Moody Mansion, Bryan Museum, and Bishop's Palace. More at galveston.com. It's island time with safety in mind. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
Business and Your Money on The Standard. I'm David Brown. For the first time since World War II, the annual State Fair of Texas will not open. Fair officials didn't think they could put on their normal show while keeping people safe from the coronavirus. From KERA North Texas, Brett Jaspers reports on the road to the big decision.
The fair started thinking about what to do back in March when the epidemic first started affecting daily life. Board Chair Gina Norris says they considered capping capacity at 50%, but decided against it.
To have the kind of state fair where everyone comes and feels welcome would be difficult in this kind of a scenario.
Now, Nora says 7,000 seasonal workers are likely out of a gig. That includes 2,500 fair employees and employees of many fair-related businesses. One of those businesses is Vandalay Industries. Owner Abel Gonzalez is famous for deep-frying butter, lobster, and other foods. The fair is a huge part of his income.
I mean, right now, it's a little tiny bit better for somebody like me. I mean, I have a restaurant that I just opened a year ago, but the virus has just been terrible.
Gonzalez says he employs 60 to 70 people to prep and work the fair. And then there's the livestock shows.
I had a friend text me telling me it was canceled, and my heart just was, I was devastated.
Ken Lee Carr of Golden, Texas is 14 years old and shows cattle. The state fair is one of her biggest events of the year, although there are other shows for now.
Hopefully that some of the shows for this fall won't get canceled and I will still be able to show them.
The State Fair of Texas itself is a nonprofit, and board chair Gina Norris called the event a massive fundraiser. But she says they'll dip into reserves to keep programs running.
Despite canceling the fair in the way we know it this year, we're going to continue to support our community outreach functions, our scholarships, and the agriculture program through the Youth Livestock Auction.
Athletic directors for the universities of Oklahoma and Texas have said this won't affect their annual football matchup at the Cotton Bowl. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Feeding hungry Texans has become an even larger task as record numbers of people are out of work and seeking help. Some of the most difficult work is in the vast rural parts of the state. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav takes us to far west Texas.
The sun's rising over the Chihuahuan Desert. Dust and sediment winding roads lead through the Precambrian features to Presidio, a speck of a town on the U.S.-Mexico border. Before the sun rose, long before it, cars began lining up in this gravel and dirt parking lot set between the town fire station and its baseball field.
Yeah, they show up about 3 a.m.
Giovanni Del Bosque works for the West Texas Food Bank. At 7 a.m., 200 cars sit in the quickly warming air. The drivers have sleep on their faces and wait for Gio to walk her team through the check-in process for this drive-through food distribution.
Household, how many names they get approved for? I brought these little markers. You just write it on the windshield.
Mass food distributions have become commonplace across Texas as unprecedented numbers look for help. But there's nothing commonplace about trying to feed increasingly needy families across West Texas's 19 counties, a region roughly the size of Maine.
Some of the local pantries have shut down, so they're referring them over to here, so we're preparing for 650 this month.
600 in a town of just over 4,000. Its former high water mark was 380, but with COVID, they have seen the numbers shoot up at least 25%. And this is just one of the 16 they do across West Texas.
Oh, this is the biggest one by far. I think our second biggest one has to be Fort Stockton. We go to Fort Stockton. We've been averaging there about 170.
The West Texas Food Bank's efforts have been hampered by contractors like San Antonio's Create a Date. They were given a $39 million contract to deliver fresh food boxes of meat, produce, and dairy, only to cancel time and time again, including three trucks just this week. The line moves quickly. The National Guard has lent them 11 people to help, and the young men and women swiftly pack potatoes, oranges, along with frozen taco meat and a box of non-perishables into each vehicle. It's about 60 pounds of food.
Our hope is that it's, you know, it's not going to last them the whole entire month, but it's going to get them, you know, 7 to 10 days worth of food.
West Texas Food Bank's Kelly Durden says now more than ever they're needed here. The two food pantries in the area are both closed, one because staff were infected with COVID. There's one grocery store in 60 miles. Not much grows in this desert, so access to fresh produce can be tough. Presidio, like everywhere else, is hurting from the current downturn.
The joke or the saying's like, there's more welding trucks in Presidio right now than there are people.
And increasingly, those trucks are coming home, she says, as jobs in oil and construction dry up. A couple dozen are here for the first time, like Jose Guevara, who drove a truck for 11 years, most recently for the Big Bend Community Center. But he hasn't worked since March. He says there should be more of these food distributions. They only do this once a month.
He said, absolutely, especially for the food.
¿Cuántos tiene en su hogar?
Tres.
He's got three people in his home.
Conrad Lujan is in his 70s, and this is his first time getting food here. The man pulls up in an old truck wearing a cowboy hat, his social security card outstretched.
Porque yo trabajo en un rancho, estoy trabajando en un rancho. Antes de comenzar el virus, estaba trabajando en un rancho.
Before the virus, he was working in a ranch, and now the virus, they're forced to come over here.
Her city already had high unemployment, so even without COVID, they would be needed here. Nancy Garcia is pretty indicative of their clientele. She's in her 40s and was on food stamps, but those ran out.
It's been like 5 months that I haven't gotten nothing, so this is very helpful. My fridge is empty, my cabinets are empty, everything is empty.
She has three adult sons, but they too struggle to find work.
This town is short of jobs, you know, it's hardly no jobs here. Nobody hardly hires nobody, you know.
They can't get two, right?
When it's her turn, Garcia asks for more than one load of food, but staff say no.
No, ma'am, it's just one.
Un por casa.
Oh, okay. Si, si. Gracias.
It's about 9:45, and they've already moved through most of the cars, more than 350. Bobby Vandenberg steps down from the back of a big red truck. Vandenberg's been driving the semi down here 5 hours one way, each month, for 6 years. He says they don't usually move this fast. The National Guard lets them run two lines.
They give us more opportunity to be out focusing more on deliveries than anything else. Because even our deliveries have increased too.
The food bank has stopped using volunteers for the most part. Today they have two or three. One is Giovanni's mother. But they lose access to the National Guard in a couple of weeks. As he locks up his trailer to leave, stragglers continue to drive up. Food bank staff hand out what's left. Ended up feeding more than 400 families today. Not quite 600, but to Vandenberg, it's clear they're needed here.
I mean, how many people do you know will come at 2 o'clock in the morning for a box of food, a bag of produce? Not a lot of people would do that.
I'm Paul Flav in Presidio.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A Texas lawmaker is joining calls for the state to halt the execution of Billy Joe Wardlow. He's set to die by lethal injection this evening for fatally shooting 82-year-old Carl Cole during a robbery in East Texas in 1993. Wardlow was 18 at the time, which his attorneys argue made him too young for a death sentence. State Representative Joe Moody backs the argument. The El Paso Democrat spoke during a virtual news conference the Lone Star Justice Alliance held Tuesday night.
This is what is completely flawed about engaging in capital punishment as a whole. There are so many issues that have to be worked through that you're inevitably going to make the wrong decision and take someone's life unnecessarily.
If the execution is not halted, Wardlow would be the first Texas inmate executed since the pandemic began. A new lawsuit says the Trump administration's attempt to expedite border wall construction discriminates against and violates the rights of South Texas landowners. TPR's Maria Mendez reports.
Carlos Evaristo Flores filed the lawsuit on behalf of Zapata County and landowners in the area. He said this is the first lawsuit in the Laredo division challenging the Trump administration on the grounds of racial discrimination.
So we believe that the communities along the border, especially in Webb and Zapata County, who are predominantly Mexican-American or Mexican or immigrant, are basically the targets of animus by the president and CBP. And we believe that it all is done in violation of the Fifth Amendment and other constitutional provisions.
Flores said the Trump administration is expected to respond within 21 days of being served. I'm Maria Mendez in Laredo.
Recent research from the University of Texas at Austin shows Black and Hispanic elementary school students in the state are far more likely than their white peers to attend schools with high poverty rates. The study published last month finds that every campus in Texas would have a 63% share of economically disadvantaged students if they were evenly distributed. But the study's author, Valerie Stern, says that's not the case on average.
In
Texas, white students are going to schools that are 44% economically disadvantaged, while black students are going to schools that are 70%, and Hispanic students are going to schools that are 74% economically disadvantaged.
Stern says elementary schools in Travis County, which includes Austin, have the largest gap in the state when it comes to school poverty rates between students of color and white students. I'm Joseph Leahy.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The Supreme Court today issued rulings in a pair of cases closely watched here in Texas. In one case, the justices voted 7-2 that employment discrimination laws do not apply to teachers whose duties include teaching religion at church-run schools. The other case is one involving new regulations from the Trump administration permitting employers with religious objections to decline to provide coverage for contraception under the Affordable Care Act. Again, the ruling was 7-2. We're going to focus on the latter case as it involves a fight that officials in Texas have long waged against the ACA. Lisa Eskow is professor and co-director of the Supreme Court Clinic at the University of Texas School of Law. Professor Eskow, welcome back to The Standard.
Good morning, David. Thanks for having me.
So, some background here. After President Obama signed the ACA in 2010, I believe it was, the next year his administration required employers and insurers to provide women with contraceptive coverage at no cost, and houses of worship were exempt, but nonprofit groups like schools and hospitals weren't. What exactly changed under the Trump administration?
So the difference is that at one point during the Obama administration, you had an opt-out process for additional religious organizations where they could certify that providing that coverage would violate their religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. And that was deemed to be a burden on free exercise. And so when you get to 2017, the Trump administration enacts a different rule that outright exempts, no need to request an accommodation, exempts way more organizations than the Obama administration had, and includes not only houses of worship, but also religious nonprofits and even publicly traded companies and schools. So it's much more sweeping in terms of who is just outright exempted, as long as you say not only that you have a sincere religious belief, but even a moral objection to including contraceptive coverage in your insurance plan for your employees.
So the Supreme Court is saying that's okay, that the Trump administration's change is okay. And now I've read that some 70,000 to 126,000 women could lose coverage from their employers as a result of this ruling, depending on which estimate you read. But I'm wondering if this might not lead to more exemptions to come.
I think that's definitely a possibility here. Excuse me, given the way that the opinion was decided, which was really a matter of how much power was given by the legislature, by Congress, to the executive branch, here the Trump administration, to decide what types of things should be covered and who gets exempted. Given that that was very broad and that broad delegation was deemed to empower this here, there's no question that additional exemptions or additional rules could come into mm-hmm. play. I do think that's a double-edged sword, because it also means that if the delegation of authority is too broad, that you may have people challenging it as unfettered and too much of an exercise of authority. So, yes.
Is there anything to stop an employer now from saying, I know what the ACA says, but I have a moral objection to contraception, so my employees will not get free birth control? Can they do that now?
You can certainly say you fit within that and you're part of that exemption. There are penalties for people who don't comply with the Affordable Care Act. But I think in this circumstance, I haven't really analyzed the repercussions, but it does seem like employers would be able to say, yes, that they have a moral objection and not include that type of coverage in their plans.
Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor were dissenters in both of the two cases that I mentioned there in our introduction. And I'm wondering, since there is an implication of, you know, religious liberty here, if these decisions tell us anything more about the ideological divide of the court, since you had the other two justices on the liberal wing siding with the majority.
You know, I do want to clarify one thing, which is Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer, who and concurred in the result here for the 7-2 result, did not say that they thought this was a good rule. They said that they thought the administration had broad authority to issue this type of rule, but Justice Kagan wrote that it could be reassessed on remand and could be found to be arbitrary and capricious. So I don't think you have a total endorsement of the rule by Justices Kagan and Breyer. I do think that on the divide, clearly Justices Sotomayor and Justice Ginsburg are reliably the two most likely to favor protecting the rights in the employment context, both with the employment decision that came down today and also in terms of health care, and particularly health care for women.
Less than a minute left, but Texas has actually led a number of states in an amicus brief on behalf of the employers who didn't want to cover contraception in this case. But I know Texas has a broader challenge to the Affordable Care Act coming up next term, right?
Absolutely. So Texas has really been out there at the forefront trying to get rid of the Affordable Care Act in numerous ways, including this most recent challenge, which is to nullify the entire bunch of legislation. And, Texas has ranked historically as one of the states with the lowest level of insurance coverage, or actually the highest level of uninsureds. And it's a big user of the exchange, but it has not expanded Medicaid as it could have under it, and continues to fight to tear it down.
Lisa Eskow is professor and co-director of the Supreme Court Clinic at the University of Texas School of Law. Professor Eskow, thanks so much for joining us on The Standard.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, helping patients fight cancer with telemedicine. Virtual online appointments are available for patients to continue their cancer journey while practicing safe social distancing. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at RaiseYourHandTexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. He was a Latinx icon whose influence reached across the world. His presence on television inspired queer people and many others to be themselves, be different. Walter Mercado did all this while sharing the thing he would come to be most known for, love. And now, about 8 months after his death, a new documentary is now available on Netflix, chronicling the legendary astrologer's life and starring himself. For more on this documentary, we talked to one of the filmmakers, Kareem Tapsch. Kareem, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, tell listeners about Walter Mercado and what he was to you in life, and how you and your fellow filmmakers decided to do a documentary on him.
Yeah, absolutely. Walter Mercado was a daily presence on Spanish-speaking television. Every day, he kind of came in the TV in the afternoon and for about 3 or 4 minutes shared the astrological forecast. But really what he was sharing was a message of love and peace and inspiration and hope, which meant so much to our families. We were immigrants and had come to this country, and sometimes days were hard. And it really kind of gave them the little push to keep going. It was also a sacred time in the household. You had to shut up. You had to pay attention. Or, grandma would knock you upside the head if you interrupted Walter Mercado. So for all of us who grew up with him, he was just this kind of ubiquitous part of our culture and a nostalgic figure that connected to our childhood and particularly our grandparents. If you don't know Walter Mercado, we best describe him as, imagine a combination of Mr. Rogers and Oprah Winfrey, but dressed as Liberace.
I was gonna say, the man had a sense of style, did he not?
I mean, I don't think I've ever come across anyone who looked like Walter Mercado. And I think that was part of his appeal for so many people. It was the first time was so visually captivating with his sequenced outfits and mystic vibes and the jewelry and, the makeup and that, perfectly coiffed hair. He looked unlike anyone you'd ever come across, not just on Latino television. I would say anywhere. He was a singular figure.
You were in the unique, albeit sad, position to be a part of the last years of his life. Tell us about your experience meeting him and being there. What was he like in person?
It's so easy to kind of look at Walter's image and chuck him up to this kind of sideshow silly thing because he was so out there looking. But the reality is he was really a brilliant, brilliant person. I remember sitting in his sunken-in living room waiting for him to walk in. And we were there for about 40 minutes, and all of a sudden we just kind of hear that voice and look up, and he was about 3 feet above us because he hadn't come down yet. And he was dressed all in white linen and gold glasses with that golden mane of hair. And we were awestruck. It was like a religious experience. But the true, you know, the real Walter Mercado wasn't too different than the one you saw on television. He was very, very loving. He was very, very charismatic. He was larger than life, but he was also down to earth. And those are really difficult balances to strike. And we had this great privilege of spending the last 2 years of his life. Of course, we didn't know that it would be the last 2 years when we sought to make the documentary. So that might be a little bit of a cosmic experience, even though we're all pretty much skeptics as the filmmaking crew. We can't deny that a lot of this had some inexplicable timing.
He had a special resonance in the Latino community, and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that aspect and why it is you think that, like, we haven't seen a character like, as you were saying earlier, Walter Mercado anywhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that part of what Walter did as a Latino is, he first of all, he broke up television, if you think about it. I mean, when he landed on the scene, he broke the mold by being somebody who visually looked different than anyone else. He challenged the notions of masculinity, of what a man should look like and dress like, by blending kind of feminine and masculine energies. And he talked about things that people weren't talking about on television, right? He took all of the religions and all of the faith systems and kind of blended them together with astrology and used those as his vehicle for a message. Now, Latinos are, you know, very, very Catholic often, just very religious and spiritual. And there's a long tradition of mysticism in there. So by kind of bringing that all together, he was really kind of touching on different things that meant something to pretty much everyone. And if you think about it from the U.S. perspective, U.S. Latinos as immigrants have, you know, had to endure so much, and days are so difficult, that when you have somebody who comes on who's entertaining, attractive to look at in the sense that you've never seen anything like him, and instills a message telling you that don't worry, today's difficult, tomorrow's going to be better, I think we can't underestimate the impact of that.
You mentioned you were with him and his family up to the end. You were in touch with him when Walter died and flew out to Puerto Rico for his funeral. What was that experience like returning to Puerto Rico after he died? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, the whole experience of making the film, certainly towards the end, was really kind of a roller coaster, for lack of a better term. We were with Walter 6 weeks before he died. And he was in pretty rough shape then, and he never talked about death. So he, you know, it wasn't a conversation we had. But he did say goodbye to us in a way twice. After we said goodbye, end of our trip, and we're about to leave, he called us back in to say goodbye again. And I think we knew that that was his way of giving us a final goodbye. We finished our cut of the film and submitted it to Sundance on November 1st. On November 2nd, Walter died. That was just another one of these inexplicable cosmic timing things that really stood out to us. We think he knew that he had a job to do and that he had done it and he could go. Going back to Puerto Rico was, you know, really difficult. It was our first time back without Walter being there. We had grown quite close. I mean, oftentimes, you know, as journalists or as documentary filmmakers, you're told you can't get close to your subjects. Well, we did get close to Walter. We became an extended part of his family and his ours. So while it wasn't surprising, obviously, by his age and by the deteriorating health that he'd passed, he was one of these people you never thought was going to die. And it was emotionally very wrought. I mean, you know, we were all there for a week, every day with the family. Our producer, Alex Fumero, and myself were pallbearers. So it was so mixed emotions, because I think that while we were grieving for Walter in a way because of his memory being tied in with our grandparents, you know, you grieve kind of a loss of your childhood at the same time. And then we get into Sundance. And the emotions of that, and we're rushing to finish the film, and then we're at Sundance, and you know, when we made the movie, we just kept thinking about how wonderful it would be to have Walter with us in Park City. I mean, he would have killed Sundance with those capes, with that look. Nobody would have known what hit him. So that was another bittersweet moment. It's just, huge and validating experience. You know, one of the largest film festivals in the world. It means so much for us as filmmakers, and yet our subject couldn't be there with us. But, you know, and it was 2.5 months after he died that we premiered at Sundance. Mm. But his family came, and I think that was, you know, part of the healing process for them was being able to see the finished film and seeing him up there. And they brought some of his capes, which we wore on the red carpet. And so while he wasn't with us physically, it really did feel like we were, you know, we had his embrace around us, wearing those capes, walking on stage and sharing Walter with the world.
Kareem Tapsch is one of the filmmakers behind Mucho Mucho Amor, The Legend of Walter Mercado, a new documentary which debuts on Netflix today. Kareem, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. U.S. Senator from Texas John Cornyn says that the United States has not completed a top-to-bottom review of our criminal justice system at the national level since 1965. Is that a fact? It's something Madeline Meckelberg and the fact-checkers at PolitiFact Texas are looking into. Madeline, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So where did this claim from Senator Cornyn pop up?
So Senator Cornyn said this during a phone call with reporters in June, and he was talking about legislation that Republicans in the Senate have put forward to reform policing, and part of that is expanding President Trump's newly created Commission on Law Enforcement, expanding their scope and responsibilities. And he was talking about this bill, talking about the need for a commission like this, and he said, exactly as you said, quote, "We haven't done this top-to-bottom review of our criminal justice system at the national level since 1965.
I suppose we need to hear a little bit more about that president's commission that you mentioned and the bill that Senator Cornyn was talking about.
Yeah, definitely. So last year, President Trump issued an executive order to form a presidential commission on law enforcement and the administration of justice. And they've been tasked with examining how to improve trust between law enforcement and their communities. And this is something that Republicans and Democrats, but largely Republicans, have been advocating for quite some time. Senator Cornyn and his colleagues have put forward various legislation like this since 2010 to establish this kind of commission. And Senator Cornyn, during this phone call, he was speaking about the Justice Act bill, which is a Republican bill that was filed in the wake of these national protests over policing and race. And the bill was ultimately blocked by Democrats who said it didn't go far enough. But the legislation included a section from a bill, a separate bill Cornyn filed before Trump's executive action, that would have established a similar commission, but with a broader scope from what Trump has ultimately ordered. And he still wants that to be under consideration to kind of expand their responsibilities there.
I want to understand something. When John Cornyn says that the U.S. hasn't completed a top-to-bottom review of our criminal justice system at the national level since 65, is he referring to the commission's work, or is he referring to the bill, or both?
He's referring to the last time there was a push at the national level to do something like this. So both the commission itself and this review, but also the instruction from the federal government. And what he's talking about here, they're pointing constantly to this year, 1965. I mentioned Republicans have tried to do this before. This is a pretty frequent talking point that 1965 was the last time there was this kind of a review. And that was when President Lyndon B. Johnson created the Commission on Law Enforcement and Administration of Justice through an executive order. And this happened as race riots were breaking out across the country. It stemmed partially from Barry Goldwater making law and order a real issue during his presidential campaign in 64. Right. And one thing Johnson wanted to address with this commission was a lack of data on police, courts, and other justice agencies to help inform decision making.
Was that the first commission of its kind, to your knowledge?
No, it actually wasn't. Before that, the most similar effort in scope to Johnson's commission was President Herbert Hoover in 1929. Wow. And he established a commission to look at the enforcement of alcohol prohibition and its effect on crime and law enforcement in other areas. So that was the first one prior to Johnson's commission. But since then, Cornyn is absolutely right. There's been no such commission or effort created since then on that kind of scale, looking at the national level. There have been smaller groups formed, outside organizations that have conducted reviews on law enforcement, but those have really been tailored to certain segments of that issue and certain agencies. But there's been nothing as robust as Johnson's effort since then.
Sounds like we're ready for a ruling.
I'm ready if you are.
Hit us with it.
We rated this claim true.
True. John Cornyn's claim that there's not been a, quote, top-to-bottom review of our criminal justice system at the national level since 1965. That ruling from Madeline Meckelberg and the fact-checkers at PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American-Statesman. Madeline, good to talk with you, and we will talk with you again next week.
Looking forward to it.
And you are listening
to the Texas Standard.
Wells Dunbar is our social media editor, and as such, he is monitoring what Texans are talking about on social media. Hello there, Wells.
This is true, David. Hello. Good to talk with you as well. Hearing from folks about, some of the breaking news we've been covering on the show, this ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court this morning, essentially making it more difficult for women to access birth control as part of their employer-led health plan if that employer has a religious or moral objection to contraception. Here are some of the remarks we're seeing on the Texas Standard Facebook page. Gabrielle Gordon's talking about boycotts. She says she wants a list of companies to avoid who won't cover birth control benefits. And as we were hearing with this ruling, the potential list of employers that could refuse to do so could rise there, it appears. Christopher Bart says it doesn't seem like a very conservative opinion to give employers and corporations the right to make family planning decisions for their employees, referring there to the conservative leanings of the Supreme Court there. So obviously a ruling that just came down, the one that we're continuing to sort of suss out the ramifications of. And of course, there are some supporters of this. Joshua Boston, he frames it as the following issue. He says, if the employer doesn't provide the benefits that that an employee wants, that person is free to get a different job with a different employer. Although other people might point out that here in the midst of a pandemic, job employment issues are definitely a little more complicated here in 2020.
True.
A little bit more breaking news, though, if in case there wasn't enough today. I'm seeing here reported by the Texas Tribune, they're reporting on a city council meeting in Houston on Wednesday. It sounds that Mayor Sylvester Turner is asking the city legal department to explore how to cancel the in-person Texas GOP commission, GOP convention, rather.
I'm seeing that.
That is, slated to meet in Houston in just a matter of days now. The Trib quoting the mayor thusly, he is asking the city legal department to look, quote, where there are provisions that would allow us to cancel this convention, we will exercise those provisions. So obviously, here as coronavirus cases continue to mount, mounting new records seemingly each day, we saw that new threshold of, 10,000 cases
10,000.
Yesterday.
Yep. Right.
Obviously, the mayor concerned about the public safety ramifications of this huge in-person meeting when all other meetings are prohibited.
I have heard that the Republican leaders are going to be speaking at that convention via video, but the convention itself, at least at last report, was going to go ahead as scheduled, and that would be a large number of people from across the Lone Star State gathering there in Houston at a time when, as you mentioned, a lot of hospitals, their hospital beds have filled rapidly, and there have been reports from across the state that there just aren't any beds at many hospitals.
Yeah, definitely so. And just picking up on something that you noted earlier, that was a fascinating little tidbit to emerge from these convention discussion plans. The fact that, the top leaders, Governor Greg Abbott, Senator John Cornyn, weren't planning for an in-person appearance. Doris Murdoch via Twitter, he said, I really love the irony of this. The top leaders doing a pre-taped portion, but the rank and file members, I guess, having to attend in person. But again, sounds like that convention may be off after all.
We're out of time for the broadcast, but we'll be back here tomorrow, and we hope you'll join us.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.